Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast about psychedelic entrepreneurship. We explore the business models and origin stories of the most interesting companies in psychedelics. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. This is the third and final episode in our microdosing series. In part one, we chatted with James Fadiman about his perspectives on microdosing after reviewing thousands of accounts.
So microdosing improves everyday life. And for people who have difficult everyday lives, meaning physical or mental difficulties, it also seems to improve a lot of those.
In part two, we chatted with Balaj Zaghetti from Imperial College London, who led the first ever self-blinded placebo-controlled microdosing study. His study showed that both the placebo and microdosing groups saw a dramatic improvement.
Microdosing really does have benefits, but we also show that taking deceptive placebos is enough to reproduce those benefits.
Yet Balaj's study was self-reported and not a clinical trial. So we really wanted to go deeper to understand how companies are designing their FDA clinical trials. Most importantly, what will it take to get FDA approval? In this episode, we chat with Diamond Therapeutics and MindMed about their microdosing clinical programs. Diamond's program uses synthetic psilocybin. They haven't officially decided on their indication yet, but they did share that they're interested in anxiety disorders. Meanwhile, MindMed is focused on using low doses of LSD to treat adult ADHD. We'll start the episode with Mike McDonald, the chief medical officer at Diamond Therapeutics. They are currently in a phase one clinical trial, so the main purpose is to determine safety and dosage. Phase one trials usually test how much of a dose someone can tolerate, as well as side effects and how it works in the body of healthy participants. Therefore, Diamond doesn't have much in the way of results yet, but we're able to learn about their strategy and hypothesis around microdosing.
So my name is Mike McDonald, and I am the Chief Medical Officer at Diamond Therapeutics.
Okay. Can you also just share with us the clinical programs that Diamond Therapeutics is working on?
Our primary focus right at the moment, as you're probably aware, is on psilocybin. We just completed a phase one, sort of a dose exploration study. So we're trying to come up with the appropriate dose to continue with the rest of this program. And we just finished that around a month ago, and the data is coming out soon. So we're very happy to look at all the PK data and to really try to find an appropriate dose to do the rest of our studies here. I'm in Canada, and we have met with our regulators here in Canada, and we are going to progress to a phase 2A study coming up. We're still kind of struggling with the actual indication, but it looks like most likely we're going to try to approach patients with general anxiety disorder and see about microdosing in that population. So that's the part that we're very, very excited about. We're trying to target it at a very low level so that we get a lot of the beneficial effects without getting to a point where it's, I wouldn't want to say debilitating, but to a point where people can still function readily, as we know many people can when they take psychedelics, and that it's actually quite beneficial.
Mike, how did you end up working in a company that's developing psychedelic therapeutics?
Well, that's a really good question. I ask myself that question all the time, actually. It's very interesting. So about 20 years ago, I started working with our chief scientific advisor, Ed Sellers, who was running a CNS-focused CRO in Toronto. I started working with him as a sub-investigator and then sort of went up through the ranks and did a lot of my own sort of phase one, phase two studies for our sponsors that would come to our clinic. And I had done that for a while, and Ed had gotten out of the business and had done some other things. And then late last year, I was approached by Ed saying, hey, there's this really exciting company in Toronto called Diamond Therapeutics. They're in the psychedelic space, and they're looking for a CMO, and thought that we'd be a good fit. And I mean, it has been just an absolute pleasure to work with Ed again and the entire scientific team. I mean, this is the most, I'd say, cohesive and comprehensive and non-ego-based group that I've ever worked with. And it's just been really exciting. And I think everyone's pulling the same way and trying to find out, like, first off, do these medications work? And if they do work, what do they work for? And how should we give them? And we really believe that microdosing is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. I think it may be helpful for listeners if you could provide a general overview of generalized anxiety disorder.
A lot of it is anxiety that essentially that's debilitating, like that's affecting your normal day to day. That's affecting thoughts. It's affecting your behaviors. There's a lot of avoidant behaviors that are associated with it. Some people are to the point where, you know, they won't even seek care because they can't leave their house. It's truly a debilitating disease, and specific treatments that are out there like really don't kind of do it justice. We do use medications like SSRIs and benzodiazepines and things like that, but there hasn't really been a specific medication targeted very well for generalized anxiety disorder. As I had mentioned, sometimes it does develop because people are so debilitated by these symptoms, it devolves into depression as well. Then you've got essentially two different disorders to deal with. It's just tragic that it's happening. And it's tragic that recent events have actually increased the number of people that have these types of symptoms. And that's why we're really interested and hopeful that we can make some good in this space.
We label these disorders like anxiety and depression, for example. But in the end, when it comes to individuals, things are not so clear or different and isolated from each other. So you were sharing, for example, this path from anxiety to depression. I'm curious if also, you know, goes the other way around or kind of like what other comorbidities are usually associated with generalized anxiety disorder.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's other features of anxiety that can be in there. There can be sort of OCD patients, so obsessive compulsive disorders. There are people with social anxiety disorders, so like have a really difficult time, say, talking with you guys. There are, there's quite a gamut of different symptoms that can happen within this scope of anxiety. But you're absolutely right. It certainly is a continuum. There's a lot of overlap between different disorders. And to sort of pigeonhole someone with this and not with this is a little bit artificial, but it's one of the ways to sort of characterize these things and be able to study them and actually come up with effective therapies for them as well.
Yeah, it's playing by the FDA rules, and that's many times what it takes to get things approved and what it takes to bring solutions for people in need. So that makes sense.
You're absolutely right.
There's a lot of different opinions about what actually psychedelics do in the brain. So it's almost unfair to ask you, you know, what microdosing does if we don't have kind of like an idea of or certainties around what psychedelics in general do. But let's give it a try anyway. And so I'm curious if you can share a little bit more around how microdosing affects or has activity in the 5-HT2A receptors. Is it only those receptors? And in case that it has activity, what does that even mean?
Well, and that's a very good question. I mean, the whole theory around all the psychedelics is sort of breaking down synapses that are counterproductive. And I mean, that's a very non-scientific way of discussing things. But we believe that actually happens in low doses as well, and definitely most likely at high doses too. If you look at some of the animal studies, and one of the ones that we've done here at Diamond, we had taken some poor performing rats. So it's a rat model where these rats are not very good at doing their day-to-day activities, and given very low dose psychedelic medications, psilocybin specifically, and their performance was enhanced. Like they became much better at doing the sort of tasks that they were asked to do.
Are you able to share some of the specific activities that the mice were doing and what was improved upon?
It's basically pulling a lever is one of the activities that the mice were able to do. And the ones that were poor performers were not very good at actually pulling that lever. After the dose of the medications, they were able to actually do what they were instructed to do as far as pulling the lever. I mean, that's one of the simple tests that they do. And it's a well-described, well-studied model. That's how they found that this was a positive effect.
You mentioned animal models, so kind of like mice. And I wonder if like there's also a placebo effect with mice. I guess there's not. And so like with this controversy around like, you know, is microdosing more effective than the placebo? I guess with mice, we cannot have one potential answer to that. So I'm wondering if you can share a little bit more around what those animal studies showed in mice.
Well, it's absolutely true. The placebo effect, or especially the expectancy effect that happens with psychedelics, and especially at low dose, it is one of the variables that's very difficult to control. And so to put that very briefly, people, when they take even low dose psychedelics, they know that they're taking something. And so it's very difficult to sort of trial this versus your typical placebo that shouldn't have any kind of an effect. So in animal models, like I would expect that there isn't much of an expectancy effect in an animal model. If you let them know that they're getting psychedelics, I don't think that would change much for them. But again, in the human models, it's probably one of the most difficult things that we have to control for is expectancy. And in the trial that I had mentioned that we had just completed, we had kind of a novel way of getting around that, which when we publish the data, we'll let you know about. But again, it's going to be a very difficult hurdle for us to get over to prove exactly what you're saying, to show that do we have an effect that's over the placebo effect. The one thing that I would say is that every dose level that we trialed, we definitely did see some psychoactive effects, not so much hallucinogenic effects. Again, I haven't seen all of our unblinded data yet, but it appears that at every level, the subjects that were in our study did sense something. They felt that they're getting some kind of a medication and it had a neuropsychiatric effect. And that's one of the things that's out there that says, you know, listen, microdosing doesn't work. We're not seeing evidence of that. It's definitely doing something. It's just a question of what it actually is doing. Where is it beneficial? That's what all of our other studies are going to hopefully help us try to elucidate.
Moving from animal to human, can you talk about how you see microdosing translating to helping address anxiety disorders and how you see the link?
Sure. I'm an emergency physician by training. And so I see people of all walks of life, especially, you know, during the latest COVID crisis, with increasing levels of anxiety and increasing desire to be treated for it or seeking help for it. I mean, I'm sure all of you know that access to care has been really, really difficult, even on a good day here in Canada, and I'm sure as well in the US, that there can be a delay for people to get care when they have issues with anxiety disorders, either seeing therapists or either seeing a psychiatrist if that's something that they want to do. The way that we see the microdosing, especially with psilocybin in our anxiety patients, is that it's a pretty easily, I think, scalable model. Like, this is a typical model that we're all sort of used to. You have a disorder, you can get a medication to help. It's prescribed by any prescriber that's out there that's comfortable giving it. So that would even be like a family physician. You know, we want to make sure that it's safe. We want to make sure that it's accessible. We want to make sure that anyone can get it wherever they are without having to go through like specialized treatment centers. There's nothing wrong with them. I'm just saying that, you know, there's always barriers to setting up larger systems where you need special therapists and, you know, to dedicate an entire day. We want to make this as accessible as possible to people pretty much anywhere that they're seeking healthcare. And so that's sort of the model that we're trying to develop. It's almost boring in a sense because it's a very traditional, listen, this is a medication that we want to give to you that's hopefully going to work very quickly with very minimal side effects that'll at least, if nothing else, bridge you to the therapy that you need, if not hopefully help with the disorder itself.
And so from a clinical study perspective, what does that protocol look like?
It's complicated. It's extremely complicated, as we're finding out. I mean, the discussions going on, trying to get into our phase 2A study have been intense, but incredibly useful to try to come up with this type of study. Again, controlling for placebo is a major part of this, and we're grappling with ways of doing it. We'd also like to do an outpatient study as well. So coming up with ways that regulators would be comfortable doing it in an outpatient setting, as well as anti-tampering ways, like all of the details are extremely complicated. And so we're actively working on that protocol right now. We've had discussions with Health Canada here in Canada about it as well, about what their expectations are. And hopefully within the next few weeks, we'll be able to come up with something a little bit more finalized and then get things operational for later this year, if all goes well, so that we can actually start doing this trial. But it is much more difficult than our phase 1 study. There's so many details to this. And then I haven't even talked about the patient population itself. Like, when you're dealing with patients with generalized anxiety disorder, it can be very challenging sometimes to reach out, to get their confidence that they want to continue with the study as well. So it's many, many details that I hadn't even considered keep coming to light, but we're working our way through it and we're going to have a robust, I hope, very successful protocol coming out very soon.
Well, the good thing of things being complicated is that also from a competitive standpoint, it's an advantage, right? Like when companies are doing something that's really hard, then, you know, other companies don't go there or don't compete. And so in at least in tech, there's many examples of companies that just did what no one else would do because it was so hard. And that was that's a huge moat. One of the things you shared around the complications is controlling for placebo effect. And you mentioned that you guys may have a novel model for doing that. So can you give us a few hints around what that looks like, what things to consider?
So we've worked very diligently to try to eliminate the fact that patients could get psilocybin versus a placebo. And so one of the ways of doing that is letting them know that there's a possibility that there are other compounds that they could take that are possible in the study. And so that it's just some information that kind of, in a sense, clears your mind and sort of opens up your perception a little bit to the fact that you may experience a lot of different things at the same time. It's trying to reduce that expectancy. There's a lot of people that really, you know, just like your question before, there's a lot of people that really are interested in trying it just for the sake of trying it potentially. And these were healthy normals as well. So if you can sort of eliminate the you're going to get this versus you're not going to get this, or there could be some other substances that you could potentially get, that's sort of just trying to clear the slate a little bit and let people really experience what they're going to experience and tell us as much as they can truthfully, you know, this is how they're feeling. Anytime someone takes one of these medications, at least in our experience so far, and anecdotally from other people, you feel something. So to be able to give someone else something that does absolutely nothing, it's quite easy for people to sense, listen, I'm actually getting the active drug or I'm getting placebo. We're working with potentially positive comparators. We're working with different messaging beforehand, you know, to kind of mask what they could potentially get. It's essentially letting people know that they may get something or they may not. And there's going to be a lot of, I don't want to say coaching, but a lot of instructions beforehand so that hopefully people understand where they're getting and that, you know, we're planning maybe even crossover studies. There's a lot in the works at the moment. I would love to tell you exactly what we're doing, but again, it's being discussed actively with our advisors over and over. And we're trying to come up with exactly, you know, what's the best approach to try to isolate that placebo effect.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak to what you understand to be it will be required to demonstrate efficacy when comparing the treated group with the placebo group?
Sure. Well, some of it is going to be our psychodynamic measurements. So there's a variety of different scales that are accepted in this field. And so we want to show some benefit. Some of it may be even as simple as, you know, if there are patients that use rescue medications, like let's say benzodiazepines for acute anxiety episodes, we may just show a measure of this is how much they used at baseline. This is what they've received after a certain amount of treatment. And has there been an improvement? You know, some of the anxiety scores out there, like the GAD-7, we may show like they've moved from a moderate to a mild severity on those sort of scoring systems.
GAD-7 is a 7-question survey used to diagnose patients with generalized anxiety disorder. It asks patients, in the past 2 weeks, how often have you been bothered by symptoms such as not being able to stop or control worrying, or feeling afraid as if something awful might happen? Patients can choose options ranging from not at all, several days, more than half the days, or every day. Their answers correspond with the number 0 to 3, and the sum of their responses determines if they suffer from minimal, mild, moderate, or severe anxiety.
So it's going to be somewhat subtle, but we're going to hopefully be able to find several objective scales that are going to be able to show us that there's some improvement. The other part with this population as well is that there is a big crossover. Like a lot of patients that have general anxiety disorder also show depressive features, and some of them like up to the point of major depression as well. So we're going to track and see if there's any kind of improvement in depressive areas as well to see what is the effect as far as that goes.
One question I was trying to figure out is that we've seen studies coming from researchers at universities. We recently chatted with Balazs Shigeti. There's also Enzo Tagliasucci, who's an Argentinian researcher who has done really good work. And I'm curious how the trials that a company like Diamond is doing are different than the ones that are being done at research organizations or universities?
We're all pulling in the same direction, I would say. I think Diamond is taking this like almost a traditional drug development approach. We're progressing very methodically through the different stages. And again, part of that is based on the feedback that we got from our regulators. So that's why we started with a phase one dose development study. We're looking to come up with compounds that could be used every day. And that may not be the similar focus that you would get in an academic center. Diamond has a commercial focus for sure, but we're also looking to improve access, people's access to medications that work for these different disorders. And that may not necessarily be the focus in an academic center. They may be looking for other pathways or trying to develop what is the mechanism for how these medications work. I'd say we're very much a pragmatic company, and we're looking to develop tools that are going to help patients as quickly as we possibly can. And again, that focus can be very different than in an academic center.
Can you speak to any adverse effects that you're aware of or you learned about in your phase one study that you can share?
Very minimal is what I would say. Typically, what we would see at some of the initial doses was some people would get a little bit of drowsiness, and it was quite self-limited. They would have it for a few hours and then it would resolve. We saw that a lot at the low doses. It kind of went away as we got into higher and higher doses. So that's an interesting part of it as well. This is a really common side effect that we'll see with most CNS drugs. When people initiate CNS drugs, quite often they'll feel some drowsiness or sleepiness, which is something that's also somewhat self-limited. After a period of time, even with commonly used medications that are out there, that effect often will wear off. So not surprised to see it, but that's really at these low doses, that's pretty much the only consistent adverse event that we saw.
And what was the compound that was being given to patients for that study?
So this is our GMP-derived psilocybin. So pure psilocybin, synthetic psilocybin, essentially. And there were no other metabolites because it's all very much lab-based.
I'm curious, do you have perspective about the entourage effect when comparing the synthetic versus the botanical? The entourage effect is a hypothesis that the combination of different compounds act synergistically to produce an enhanced effect. Psilocybin mushrooms actually have multiple metabolites, including psilocybin, baocystin, norbaocystin, aerogenesin, and more. The psychoactive effect in psilocybin mushrooms has historically been attributed to the psilocybin, but there are some other metabolites in the mushroom which may contribute to its effect. For example, there are reports that link aerogenesin to a euphoric mood. Research on this topic is still in progress and being debated, but what we do know is that most synthetic versions of psilocybin mushrooms just include psilocybin.
We try to eliminate as many variables as we can to try to say, listen, this is working or it isn't. And really, we don't know. We don't know what those other metabolites in a mushroom preparation would actually be. That's why we wanted to keep it as straightforward and as variable, not variable rich, but without variables as we could. And that's why we selected the synthetic psilocybin.
And why did you choose psilocybin over, let's say, LSD, which also there's a lot of anecdotal evidence around microdosing?
Absolutely. The decision was made before I joined the company, but I think the reason that we chose to go down this road was some of it was practical. Like, we did have a provider that was able to produce it. We also felt that for our purposes, for microdosing, that it was probably a decent one to start with. Seemingly maybe a little milder than LSD potentially, maybe less side effects, is the reasoning around why we picked psilocybin.
While Diamond is focused on developing a medicine with microdoses of synthetic psilocybin to potentially treat anxiety disorders, MindMed is evaluating the use of LSD in microdoses, or as the company calls it, repeat low-dose administration. And they want to treat adult ADHD. They are currently in phase 2A clinical trials. A phase 2 clinical trial treats patients with the condition to assess its effectiveness. Phase 2 trials also study the optimal dose and further study the drug's safety. We chatted with Dan Carlin, the company's chief medical officer, to fill us in on MindMed's approach to their clinical trial. So wanted to start by just hearing a bit about yourself, MindMed, and then we can zoom into the specific questions around how to think about microdosing and how it can really help address ADHD.
I'm Dr. Dan Carlin. I'm a psychiatrist by training. I'm also board certified in addiction medicine and clinical informatics. I have a faculty appointment at Tufts University in the School of Medicine, and I'm on the medical staff at Montefiore Medical Center here in New York. I came to MindMed via somewhat unusual route. I had developed drugs at Pfizer in psychiatry when Pfizer was doing psychiatry, and then ended up helping to build a group called Digital Medicine at Pfizer, which led me, when I left Pfizer in 2018, to co-found a company called Health Mode, which was focused on digital measurement across a range of conditions to try to better understand diseases that are largely defined by their symptoms. Two Februaries ago, we've completed the purchase of Health Mode by MindMed, and that brought me to MindMed as the chief medical officer. And it brought along a team of technologists and engineers and product folks to continue to work on digital measurement alongside the drug development efforts. MindMed is, at its core, a brain health-focused pharmaceutical company. And though we obviously have many associations with psychedelics, and we're working on LSD, which is almost a definitional psychedelic, our interests aren't limited to psychedelics. And in some cases, our interest in psychedelics may not have a ton to do with the psychedelic effects of them. So a discussion like this one about other effects that the drugs that are psychedelic might have that don't depend on that psychedelic experience are always really interesting for us.
Why don't you give us a brief update in terms of where MindMed is at with regards to the LSD microdosing studies for ADHD?
Yeah, and one fun thing that I'll do right at the beginning, while we don't disagree with the term microdose as a word or a concept necessarily, in our business of pharmaceutical development, we don't really use the word microdose. You know, there are other psychiatric drugs where the dynamic range in which they're dosed, think of a drug like Seroquel, which can be dosed from 25 milligrams all the way up to almost 3 grams a day. That's an enormously wider range than the range we're talking about with, say, LSD, where a so-called microdose might be 20 micrograms and a full dose might be 200 micrograms. So even the idea of microdose to us is a little strange. When you develop drugs and they have doses. And almost every drug has different effects at different doses. This is actually kind of normal for drug development. So we just talk about the dose of the drug and don't necessarily acknowledge that we need to be talking about micro or macro or anything else. These are just a drug given at different doses, and it has different effects at different doses like you'd expect with any other drug. So with regard to our microdose study, what we call the ADHD study is the low repeat dose LSD study in ADHD in adults. And again, that sort of makes it more coherent to the world of pharmaceutical development. And I don't think any less coherent to folks who do think about microdosing because they know what we mean. That study we announced at the end of last year had initiated, and it's continuing to run. So as with almost any research of this type, you have more than one site running. Right now, we've got a second site activating, and we are continuing, not us, but our investigators at these sites are recruiting and enrolling participants who are being dosed.
Can you provide an overview of ADHD?
Yeah, it's a lifelong syndrome that probably looks more like a spectrum, and the primary cognitive domain that exists on that spectrum is attention. Attention is the quality of our brain that allows us to attend to a thing, right? To suppress extraneous information and to purposefully pay attention to some stimulus. And so what this looks like for a kid in school is the stimulus they're supposed to be paying attention to is whatever's happening, the teacher's doing, or on the blackboard or whatever. And instead of being able to attend to that, they end up off topic, off target, attending to other things in their environment. The manifestations of that inattention can also be behavioral discontrol. So a degree of hyperactivity, which is, of course, in the name as well. And we think of there being really two subtypes of ADHD, though, as I said before, this probably doesn't adequately cover the buckets that you could categorize ADHD into. But we think primarily of there being a hyperactive subtype and an inattentive, a sort of quietly inattentive subtype, and that those might not feel different to the person who has them. They might feel very different to the people who are around that person. And so someone who's fundamentally, say, inattentive in school, but just seems to be behaving themselves, right? They're just sitting there tuned out. They might underperform, and that might be mistaken for capacity to perform in school, where really, if they were able to pay attention, they'd be able to do much better at school tasks. Whereas the hyperactive subtype tends to be seen as a behavioral problem, right? And so often is the case when behaviors are disruptive to the primary thing that's supposed to be happening in the room, that they get labeled as bad kids, right? Who are preventing other kids from learning or don't care. And so that can lead to a whole different set of problems where instead of being seen as someone with the capacity to learn, but the difficulty with sitting still and paying attention, they get sort of labeled as a disruptive kid and they get into disciplinary trouble, right? So you can see how the same core feature of the disease could lead to two very different presentations and two very different outcomes for someone growing up with the disease. We also know that it persists into adulthood in many cases, and that it can be developed in adulthood.
I'm familiar with lots of anecdotal accounts of people who say that microdosing or low repeat doses of LSD or psilocybin help with focus. Can you speak to how you're thinking about, I guess, both the mechanism of action, like in terms of the neuroscience and biology, and how that really translates into focus?
So these are excellent and really difficult questions. And so as you know, I'm sure better than I do, the anecdotal reports around repeat low-dose administration of LSD include all sorts of benefits. People talk about increased attention or focus. People talk about clearer cognition. People talk about better creativity. So there's a lot of a sense that many folks feel like they're able to do the things they want to do better while taking a low dose of psychedelics on somewhat of a regular basis. As I'm sure you also know, that doesn't always bear out in more, let's say, controlled clinical research, right? So this gets into some tricky questions about the placebo effect, which always is raised in the context of people deciding to take a thing, feeling they've sustained some benefit. And then other folks say, oh, well, then we should do a randomized clinical trial of that. And sometimes the difference between the active drug and the placebo seems to sort of wipe out the perceived benefit. So the way we see the study that we're running in adult ADHD is one of these controlled blinded studies that, you know, folks don't actually know what they're getting. And therefore, we can look at the difference in the changes in people who are getting active drug from folks who are getting placebo and see if some difference emerges. That question, answering does it work or not, doesn't depend on, nor does it really help us understand the neuroscience. And this is, I think, a really critical point. We can talk about the underlying mechanistic concepts in psychiatric drug development, but I might disappoint you in that I can't tell you how it works because I don't know how it works. And folks who claim that they do are basing their claims on some body of evidence, but there's by no means conclusive evidence as to why large dose of LSD helps your mood or why small doses of LSD might help with your attention. We really just don't know at this point. And what I always say next is, that's okay. We don't really know how SSRIs work, right? And that's a drug those are a class of drugs that have been studied so extensively that you say, well, we ought to know how they work. And we know that they do work in some people, and we're getting better and better at knowing in whom they will work. But there's always a gap in the world of psychiatry between the explanatory neuroscience of a thing and the fact that it has an effect on people's mood or cognition or attention or whatever else. So in order to develop drugs like this, you kind of have to live with that uncertainty and accept it. Do what you can as you do your research to try to build a body of knowledge that might contribute to understanding the underlying neuroscience. But the neat thing about clinical research is clinical outcomes are really based on how folks feel and function and in some cases survive. And that's what we care about because we want people to feel better and do better. And it's what regulatory bodies care about because that's what gets drugs approved. A really important second concept when you think about any drug development, but I think to a greater extent, a psychiatric drug development is the placebo response. And in research world, when we're wearing our researcher hats or our drug developer hats, the placebo response is the bad guy, right? It's something we want to try to minimize and get rid of as much as we can. But it's always really important to point out that there's a reason we test all of our drugs against placebo, and that's because placebo is the best drug for the most things. Name another drug that works for so many other conditions, works for as many people as it does, and in many cases works as well as it does. And that's across a hugely wide range of disease areas. So in our clinical hats, when we're out treating patients, we do what we can to maximize the placebo response because in the end, with an active drug, what you actually get out of the drug in the real world is drug effect plus, if you're doing your job well, placebo response.
I guess there's a even broader question about the way that clinical trials are set and what's the FDA criteria towards approving something. Because as you said, in an alternative universe or maybe in the future, there will be a way that drug development companies can use placebo in their favor. It feels today that it's quite the opposite, right? Like it's something that, because placebo is so effective, it plays against drugs being approved to a certain extent.
Yeah, we have a really hard job in drug development, which is that we're trying to learn something true about the world. And in the case of, say, low-dose repeat LSD for ADHD, we're trying to learn, does that drug in that paradigm help people with their attention? Right? This is a true thing. It either does or it doesn't, or more likely that ADHD is not a very robust construct. So a lot of people who have this thing called ADHD both exist on an attentional spectrum and their underlying neurobiology is different from one another. And it could be maybe categorizable into different buckets, but we don't know how to do that yet. And so the real truth is that it probably helps some people, doesn't help others. Maybe it makes some people a little bit worse, because why not, right? And that in the midst of all of that complexity, we're trying to sort out, is this something where the benefit to most people who would get it because they have the diagnosis exceeds the potential risk to those people? And that's fundamentally the job. So using a placebo control is just another way of saying, well, what we don't want to discover is that going into a clinic to get dosed two or three times a week and having people pay attention to your mental health and pay attention to your attention and ask you questions about your attention, maybe that's the beneficial part. So what we don't want to do is try to bring a drug forward to market or forward to a regulatory agency until we've at least been able to develop enough evidence that we're satisfied that the drug is in fact doing some of the work and it's not all the other things around its administration.
Let's chat for a few minutes around the clinical studies that you're doing. So what can you share so far from the phase two studies that you are conducting in partnership with Maastricht University?
Nothing more than that they've started in the design. So we've obviously announced and have publicized the design of the study, which is a two-arm study, placebo versus active, and a six-week primary observation period. One of the interesting things about pharmaceutical development is that as the sponsor, the company that sets up the research, pays for the research, and that ultimately will potentially use the research for regulatory submissions and then marketing, has not a whole lot of visibility into the actual details of the trial as it's happening. So while we know about recruitment rates, because we need to know that sites are getting folks in and we need to be able to try to project out when we'll have data, we don't know anything about the outcomes until the study's ready for a readout. And part of that has to do with the fact that these studies are run double or triple blinded, that the participant doesn't know whether they're getting active or control, that the researcher, the person giving them the drug, doesn't know if they're giving active or control. And then in some cases where you have third-party raters, so in our GAD study, for example, where there's someone who's not at the site remotely administering a rating scale, that person is also blinded to whether to what the participant is getting. And it, if you haven't been involved in drug development, it makes it an interesting exercise because you do a lot of thinking up front as to how to best design a study and how to best maintain the blind and how to dose and when to dose and what assessment instruments to use and how to train the people who are using those assessment instruments. There's just all this planning that goes into designing the best study you can. And then you start it and it runs. And it runs for some period of time. And if your recruitment rates are what you hope they'll be, it runs for the amount of time you thought it would be. They don't often go faster than you hoped. And sometimes they can go slower. And then at the end, you get an unblinded data package. And you finally get to see the truth underlying the thing is. And it's a lot of work to get it started. Then there's this waiting period where you try to monitor and make sure everything's running the way it's supposed to be running. And then you find out the answer at the end, good or bad.
During the waiting period is when you go on podcasts and vacation, right?
Podcast for sure. I can tell you that. It's vacation again.
Yeah. One other question in terms of the study design, why LSD and not psilocybin?
I think that it's not so much a why one and not the other as you have to pick, your weapon here. And MindMed has gone in on LSD, which is not to say we think that it, we don't know yet whether it's how it performs relative to psilocybin. There's some reasons that we like LSD. It's highly, highly potent. So LSD is widely considered, if not the most potent, certainly among the most potent neuroactive chemicals. And so in an LSD study for low dose, you might be talking about 20 micrograms. And for our highest dose condition in our GID study, you're talking about 200 micrograms. This is still hundreds of times lower than you would go with another less potent drug. That potency opens up options that might not be available with lower potency chemicals. Also, we know that these drugs affect people differently, acutely, right? Even acutely. So folks who are experienced with psychedelics would describe the effects of, say, psilocybin and LSD differently. And the time courses are different. There are a lot of differences between them. So there's no reason to think that the effects on psychiatric illness might be different. How exactly, we don't know, but it seemed to make more sense to you know, I think each company looked at the array of what was available to them and what other companies were pursuing and tried to pick a space where they had both a good reason to make a bet and where they thought that they wouldn't be running up against a competitor. Though I hesitate to say competitor because I think really what we are in this field is peers. There's no shortage of folks who are suffering, and anybody doing well here is good for all of our prospects to be able to bring effective drugs to market. A dozen SRI or similar drugs on the market right now, each one of them did just fine, and each one of them works a little differently and works better for some people than for others. So in the end, more options are better. And particularly, more options are better if we start to develop an understanding of which option will work best for whom in an a priori way. So that based on your presentation, maybe based on some degree of digital measurement, based on clinicians' experience using these drugs as treatments, it won't be just random chance which one you get, but that it will be a decision informed by data that maximize the chances that the first treatment is the one that's most likely to be right for you.
Yeah. One attribute that is dawning on me is that LSD does have a longer duration than psilocybin. So for study and focus, I could see it also being beneficial.
It's interesting when you think about ADHD drugs, the ones that exist, the psychostimulants, are really when you take them, they work. And they work for a duration of time based on their pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. And then when they come off, they really come off. And the person should be back to whatever their baseline is. That's one mechanism through which drugs work. Another is, say, like SRIs for depression and anxiety, where folks take them every day. And then over time, they start to have symptomatic change. But it's not about what time of day they take it or anything else. Again, since we don't know how they work, or for that matter, really, if they work yet, we don't know if the potential attentional benefits of a drug like LSD would be something that start in the morning when you take it and wane through the day and then you don't get any effect the next day, and then maybe 2 days later when you take it again, it works again. Or if repeat dosing over time creates an effect that is a little more persistent. In our MDMA program for autism spectrum disorder, we're really thinking of our MDMA as being much more like the psychostimulant model, where someone with ASD might take it in the morning, sustain the benefit through their school or work day, and then by nighttime, the drug effects would have waned. They could sleep normally and then take it again the next day and sustain the benefit while the drug is on board. So in the case of low-dose LSD, we just don't know yet.
The other point I was thinking on, most tryptamines and ergotamines like LSD have 5-HT2B activation, and it is thought that, you know, potentially 2B activation can affect cardiovascular functioning. So how are you measuring that or keeping tabs on that, so by the end of the study you kind of have some data around it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we think of 5-HT2A, so serotonin 2A, as being the trip mechanism, right? That's the thing that if you block it and you give someone a 5-HT2 activator that usually causes a trip, it doesn't. There are drugs that hit 5-HT2A that don't cause a trip. So it's not enough just to be on 5-HT2A. Brian Roth proposed a definition for psychedelics being drugs that activate 5-HT2A and create an LSD-like experience. So that's how we're doing so far in defining psychedelics. I think that's the best working definition. There is 5-HT2B. Some drugs that agonize, which is just to say activate, bind to and activate 5-HT2B, have been implicated in the development of fibrosis in the heart, which is the cardiovascular effect that causes the most concern to regulators, to drug developers. It's led to some reluctance, a great deal of reluctance, to develop 5-HT2B drugs, specifically ones that you take over and over again. Interestingly, LSD has never been implicated, that we can find, in the development of valve fibrosis in the heart. So at least in the case of this low-dose LSD, while we are keeping an eye on cardiovascular parameters, it's not something we're specifically, we're of course worried about it, but it's not something we're specifically think that we will have a problem with. But across the class of drugs that interact with the serotonin system, there's always this worry that we have to be attentive to and strive to minimize any risk of valvular fibrosis.
Dan, there's one other question that I'm interested in. It's really about the business. In terms of how a company like MindMed thinks about intellectual property when it comes to working with a compound like LSD, what's the philosophy around what ultimately can become defensible for the business?
The question of intellectual property and protection, and how do you build a business where some of your drugs have been around for 70 years is a great one. It's one we obviously get a lot. Our general sense is that, and of course I would say this because we're never going to have a chemical patent on LSD. It's a chemical that we can't patent because it's been patented a long time ago. Is that there are a lot of ways to defend a new drug. And so FDA marketing exclusivity is a huge part of that. And that alone, there are plenty of NCEs that did have a patent that took long enough to get to market because they were difficult to develop, or they got shelved for a while, or they got moved between companies and licensed and sold. So there's lots of examples of drugs coming to market that didn't have chemical matter protection, but because of the protections that are granted through regulatory approvals, we're able to do very well in the marketplace. And what that opens up then for subsequent generations of molecules, whether the particularly if you're using the same chemical, which you don't have a matter patent for, or all the sorts of things you can do around formulation and dose form, and to my mind, the opportunity to build digital support tools that can be labeled with the drug that start to prolong the period of exclusivity and make it I wouldn't say necessarily more difficult for new entrants, but that make the thing you offer as a company more attractive than what someone could bring in behind it with the same chemical matter. So while we are very tuned in to opportunities for patents and use patents and other things that we can get that will help to protect our ultimately our market share around the thing that we've developed and gotten approved, it's not all patents, and there are opportunities for patent that go far beyond composition of matter.
Microdosing expands the definition of what a psychedelic experience is. We think about psychedelics as this hallucinogenic, intense experience, and microdosing is quite the opposite. It is an altered state of consciousness, but it's a lot more gentle.
Yeah, I think its gentleness also makes it a gateway for a much wider adoption, because there are certainly people who are anxious about the full-blown trip. And so microdosing is this gentle alternative that I think will appeal to a lot more people.
And at the same time, there's a clear explanation offered in the episodes around how clinical trials, clinical studies, and anecdotal reports converge. And the answer to that may be the placebo effect. I was just going through an article that shared that regulators in Europe are close to approving an over-the-counter treatment for erectile dysfunction. And what is interesting about this treatment is that it's a gel that was once used as a placebo. It's literally an inactive gel. But when they were running clinical trials, this inactive gel worked as well as the agent that was actually tested. Both worked. And so now this European company may get approval for a treatment that is just a placebo.
I mean, you are the placebo, right? And if you believe something, your physiology follows.
It's just amazing how we've known this for so long, but at the same time, we keep underestimating the placebo effect. I wonder how things may change if this idea of the placebo effect is embraced by everyone in the psychedelic community.
Speaking of effects, can we talk about the entourage effect and how not having a conclusive understanding about what metabolites ultimately influence the psychedelic qualities, and specifically with psilocybin, how there's all these metabolites that may be contributing to it. I think about approaches for, you know, on the one hand, you have a company like Diamond that is just doing synthetic psilocybin, so it doesn't have the other metabolites, baocystin, norbaocystin, et cetera, that, again, may contribute to the psychedelic experience. But maybe it's the case that just the synthetic psilocybin works, right? Compass is doing a similar approach. And so, yeah, it's one of these unsolved mysteries that I'm enjoying to follow and learn about.
I also want to highlight Balaj's clinical study design. This could be a game changer. And what I mean by that is that he relies on self-blinding, and that gives scale, and that makes the studies more cost-effective. And many times in entrepreneurship, we talk about how restrictions promote creativity and how the best entrepreneurs excel at this. And I like the idea of very rigorous scientists also embracing it.
One thing that could be interesting to quickly highlight, even Balaj's self-blinding approach, like there are still a lot of unanswered questions around expectancy bias and breaking blind, right? Where people guess that they're taking the substance. There's some very big unanswered questions around study design still. So, Matthias, do you believe microdosing works?
Well, I believe in the scientific method, and I want to see more studies and more people asking this question and working towards finding answers.
There is something about this does it work question that seems to resonate with you on a deeper level. There's something about the science versus belief, right?
Yeah, it's the eternal question for every investor, because if you wait until everything's clear, the science is perfectly defined and accepted by the establishment, then there will be already companies that are very advanced. So as an early stage investor, it's something that I need to think through all the time. How much Do I focus on things that I believe that are not actually 100% proven, and how much I stay grounded in reality?
I think it's worth noting that while there are dozens of companies that are going through FDA clinical trials for microdosing or repeat low dosage administration, you have a lot of people that are microdosing at home today, right? You have that happening on a increasingly growing level. And at the same time, you have more advocacy work for decriminalization and legalization, organizations like the Microdosing Collective. And so I think that what's really interesting to follow is the fact that there's many different ways that people seem to be seeking out microdosing or trying to expand access in the case of clinical development. But at the same time, many people are not going to wait for the science. They're just going to do it themselves.
To end, I want to acknowledge that we haven't invested in a microdosing company yet. And this series helped me learn more about the science and keep building a stronger thesis around microdosing and why it may or may not work in a medical setting. All I can say for now is that I'm staying open-minded to companies and researchers working on this space, and I am embracing the mystery.
This is Business Trip, a podcast about psychedelic entrepreneurship. If you like this episode, you can help us by subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. You can tweet at us or find us on the gram at BusinessTripFM. And if you're building a company in psychedelics or looking to get more involved in this space, email me at greg@businesstrip.fm. I'm Greg Kubin, and Business Trip was co-created by me and Matthias Serebrinski. Producer and editor is Jonathan Davis. Sound design and engineering came from Zach Frank. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional music credits are in the show notes. This is Business Trip. Thanks for tripping with us. We'll see you next time.
How is your personal relationship with microdosing?
It's really interesting.
You microdose?
You know, it's an interesting thing, and
I haven't felt the need to microdose or high dose either, but I am definitely open to it.
I'm going to fully dodge the question by saying that in most areas of medicine, you don't ask your orthopedic surgeon, you know, have you ever broken your ankle? Because it shouldn't matter, and you wouldn't want their broken ankle to be the thing they fall back on when they're fixing your ankle.
The more that we talk about this, and the more that we talk to other people that actively do this, I'd definitely be interested in looking into it. If it's legal, and it's a legal substance that we can take, I would definitely think about trying it for sure.
Everyone has their own life experience, their own lived experience, their own experience of their illness, and if I were to bring my experience to the table instead of focusing on theirs, I'd risk anchoring too heavily on me and not on them. So we're not developing drugs for ourselves. We're developing drugs for folks out there who need them. And ultimately, the commercial pathway has to be oriented toward those folks, not toward what we might have done or seen or experienced.
Do you microdose?